or you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the writers at the Texas Observer to take a break from writing things down and say things to you on the radio instead. Back with us once again is Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder. Welcome, Forrest.
Hi, Jonathan.
Also with us is our Observer staff writers Patrick Michaels and Melissa Del Bosque. Glad to have you both with us.
Good to be here.
Thanks.
Well, we have a lot of news to discuss, quite a bit, actually. Before each episode, we bang out what we'd like to talk about, and we've got so many stories to get through this time. And the gubernatorial race is continuing to heat up, and we've been talking about it just about every week. And this week, I'm really excited about it because it's the Nugent edition of this discussion. Forrest, tell us what's going on with Ted Nugent.
Well,
seriously, what is
going
on?
What is going on?
What is wrong with this man? It reared its head again in our airspace this week.
Oh, God.
Sarah Palin reference. He is appearing with Greg Abbott, or did appear with Greg Abbott at an event this week in Wichita Falls, a campaign event for Greg Abbott. And this comes not long after Ted Nugent made the latest in a long history of... how should we say, insane
offensive
and racist
things?
And sexist remarks, this time reached probably a new low, referring to President Obama as a, quote, subhuman mongrel, among other things he said in an interview with Guns.com, of course. So, you know, the situation here is one in which the Republican front runner for the GOP nominee for governor is embracing Ted Nugent, whose comments you would think would put him well outside the mainstream. I mean, he's known for palling around with, you know, politicians like Steve Stockman or, you know, Sid Miller, the guy who's running for ag commissioner. But those are more obscure figures. They're sort of fringe characters. And Greg Abbott is widely considered to be the favorite for governor. He's supposed to be sort of a mainstream guy, and here he is kind of going out of his way to figuratively and literally sort of embrace Ted Nugent. And so,
what is the political benefit to embracing Ted Nugent?
You know, it's a little hard to figure out, to be honest. I mean, he's the shoe-in for the nomination, so he's already looking forward to the general election. And, of course, he's running against Wendy Davis. I think that, you know, Occam's razor says that he's trying to appeal to Republican voters and a particular type of Republican voter. And Ted Nugent is popular among, you know, certainly Second Amendment enthusiasts, gun enthusiasts, as well as people who just sort of get off on politically incorrect language.
And bow hunting.
And bow hunting. And, you know, Ted Nugent is just kind of I was going to say rock star. I mean, he is at least a washed up rock star. But in another sense, he's a rock star for the kind of Tea Party right. But, you know, the question is, was it a smart move, or did he go too far this time?
What do you guys think?
Well, there was that thing on CNN, I guess Anderson Cooper had a reporter at an Abbott campaign event who straight up asked him, like, hey, do you think this was still a good idea to have Ted Nugent, up with you at a campaign event, and do you regret that decision? And he sort of explained why he did it, the idea was to draw a contrast between him and his his supporters, who were all about Second Amendment rights and, you know, I guess in Ted Nugent's case, open carry all the time under any circumstance.
Even though Wendy Davis is now in favor of open carry.
So what he was saying is this is to sort of call out Wendy Davis for her hypocrisy and saying she's for Second Amendment rights, even though Mr. Second Amendment rights Ted Nugent, you know, presumably doesn't like her very much, and you know, said that, you know, she wasn't his candidate. I think you could probably, and this is the CNN reporter had this to say. He was like, well, you could find a lot of people to support the Second Amendment. You didn't need to pick Ted Nugent, and I think that, you know, there's really not a clear benefit to him. He's not going to win anything he wasn't going to win already.
Although the other people you could have picked were probably not in damn Yankees.
Yeah. There's a surprising amount of Ted Nugent knowledge coming out here.
I'm not revealing anything.
Okay. I mean, I think that the risk is, I mean, there's just the kind of ethical issue. Should in 2014, should we be embracing people who routinely say things that are deeply offensive. I mean, you know, we could sit here and analyze the meaning of subhuman mongrel when referring to a black president, but I think we probably all get it. Interestingly, the Awesome American Statesman pointed out that that exact phrase, subhuman mongrel, had been used at a Klan rally in Waco not so long ago by some of the speakers there. So there's a, you know, there's a history to that phrasing, and it's extremely ugly. The other thing is the political cost. I mean, we have a lot of people in the Texas GOP going around saying we've got to do more to reach out to groups beyond our base, which frankly it's white folks, men, rural, conservative. We need to do more to reach out to minorities. You know, Latinos is who we normally talk about, but African Americans presumably as well. And you know, I think putting yourself in a position where you're associated with Ted Nugent, who by the way called Greg Abbott his blood brother at this event, might be stupid just simply on the tactical and strategic political level, whether you're a cynic or not.
After Abbott kicked off his campaign as sort of advertising his candidacy as you know, a new day in the party, that, you know, he's, you know, look at my family, for example, you know, and his wife is Latina, and he's saying that, you know, his family is an example of the great cultural diversity of the state. And then he's got his blood brother up on stage with him, who's you know, complaining about a president whose family you know, comes from an interracial marriage.
I kind of think Greg Abbott might just be like, well, you know, probably maybe thinks of Ted Nugent as a bit of a clown, and he is a clown. I mean, what's going on with that guy is I think he loves the attention, he loves being a clown. But well, okay, he's a racist clown, and that's just, you know, that's problematic.
I can't imagine that women voters are going to be attracted to that message either. I mean, if Greg Abbott's trying to reach out to women voters, I think he's doing himself a real disservice by, you know, partnering up with Ted Nugent, of all people.
But what about Wango Tango? I mean, aren't women into that?
Good God.
I'm sorry, you may be not familiar with the the Ted Nugent override.
I just know Cat Scratch Fever. That's the only one I know.
Because, like, every time I think that I can go on with my life not being aware of the Ted Nugent something else comes up. He just shows up somewhere else.
Fame.
And then
just comes back.
So, well, the other thing that we talk about a lot when we talk about the governor's race is, you know, how Wendy Davis's campaign is handling the latest twists and turns. And this is a situation where it really seems like they're coming out hard, and the, you know, she's got other state reps and the Democratic Party have come out as well. It's kind of hitting Abbott over this, but I mean, I've just been getting press releases all day from her campaign and her campaign manager just talking about how, you know, they're calling on Abbott to renounce Nugent's language and just drawing all kinds of attention and fundraising, I believe, you know, off of this stuff too. I mean, they're really kind of going all out to you know, make it pretty clear to people that you know, that this happened.
And it's interesting because basically what Greg Abbott has said when asked is that he was not familiar with things that Ted Nugent had said in the past, which strikes me as being either
hard to believe.
Well, implausible.
That's a hard to believe.
Implausible, yeah. I think, is probably, you know, the answer. But then also, or extremely incompetent on the part of his staff not to inform him of Ted Nugent's long and well advertised remarks about women and minorities and whatnot. But
maybe he thought he was getting Ted Cruz instead.
Maybe that's it.
Do you think this is a sign of that he's worried, that he thinks he's just not going to get the Tea Party vote? I mean, is this a sign of desperation on his part?
You know, I think in a sense it's because basically now to be a Republican and especially to run for statewide office, the playbook is actually like kind of thin. You hate Obama and you just run as far to the right as possible.
He hasn't got a NASCAR yet. I'm waiting for that. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's, yeah, par for the course.
When Perry got his NASCAR.
But, you know, so I think that, like, they've just gotten used to this, and here is somebody who is more of a viable challenger, you know, maybe there it's confused the strategy just a little bit.
I guess if he's trying to draw contrasts between himself and his opponent, he did a pretty good job with this one.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio from the folks at the Texas Observer. And there is a subject we're going to discuss on the show today that I was not really well versed in until we talked about it in a meeting the other day. And here's the question I'm going to ask you, Melissa. What is a politiquera?
A politiquera is a for-hire political worker. Typically, this is down in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas. And it's somebody that candidates who are running for office pay to go out and organize people to come out and vote. They'll give them rides to the polling places. And right now, since we're in early voting, this is a crucial time when politiqueras are very heavily involved in the politics down there, because the primary basically is the election, because of the Valley being such a Democratic stronghold. So what happened back in late December was that three politiqueras were indicted arrested by the FBI. And what is alleged was that they were buying votes and in some cases providing cigarettes or drinks to people for votes. And in one case, one of the politiqueras was even driving somebody to their drug dealer after they'd gotten the money for their vote. So they're pretty bad charges, and it's really shook up the political community down there. Politiqueras are very much part of the system, but in the last decade, they've kind of taken on a more maybe negative connotation, the word has, because of this sort of ethical slide into this pay-for-votes scheme that is going on with some of the politiqueras.
So, I mean, there's nothing... The first part of your description, how you describe a politiquera, is basically somebody who works for a campaign and helps turn out the vote. So there's nothing unusual or weird or wrong about that.
Right? No, and it's actually quite a benefit. They're community organizers, and most of these votes are coming from low-income, isolated areas like colonias or from assisted living centers and senior centers. These are folks that are disenfranchised usually and not very involved in the voting process. So it was originally a really positive thing, and it's still there are still good politiqueras too. But in the last decade, what people are telling me in the Valley is that there's been so much money injected into the whole political process that the politiqueras have really upped the game, where they will go to one candidate and say, you know, for $5,000, I can provide this many votes for you, and then they'll go to the candidate's opponent and say, hey, this guy just said he'd pay me $5,000. If you don't pay me $6,000, then I'm going to go work for him against you, and I'm going to bring these many votes out against you. So they will work candidates off of each other. And some candidates will even pay them just to get off their back, and they won't even actually work. They'll just take the money. So it's kind of become like a more of an extortion of candidates.
Well, do we have any information on whether the candidates know what some of these politiqueras are doing in exchange for votes? Because it's one thing to hire basically a campaign worker and say, yeah, go turn people out to vote. It's another thing to hire a campaign worker, say, go turn out people to vote by paying them to vote.
Right.
You know, you cross
giving them cigarettes or whatever
into a dark area or of illegality at some point.
Well, in the indictments, they haven't revealed yet who the candidates were or who the campaign managers were who were involved. And it's interesting. This was actually kind of tragic because it was the Donna school board race. And Donna's this small town, you know, just east of McAllen. And the head of the school board actually committed suicide around the time that these women were indicted. And nobody has come out publicly and said that they were linked, but most people assume that it was all linked. So these indictments have really shaken up the political system down there. And I was talking to a political science professor down at UTPA in Edinburgh today about it, and he was saying, well, with this negative news and what's going on, I think that, you know, some of the candidates maybe won't use politiqueras, but I'm not sure that this is going to really make a dent in it because they're just so endemic within the system of politics down there.
Well, of course, it could maybe the situation will be that you still have politiqueras, but maybe they won't perhaps think a little bit more about engaging in illegal activity. Is that Could that be one outcome?
Definitely. And that's what he was saying, too. You know, this is the first time that the FBI has prosecuted somebody for this, you know, for this for election fraud. Typically, it's left up to the local DA or the state to prosecute these kinds of frauds. But so they're thinking now with the FBI sending this message that maybe it will help clean up the practice somewhat.
There's another thing I learned about this week. It's a question. Where is America's highest rate of uninsured folks? Patrick, can you fill us in?
I'm glad you asked me that, Jonathan. I'd love to tell you.
You're welcome.
I was surprised to learn. I mean, we talk a lot about how Texas has the highest uninsured rate in the country, with about 1 in 4 Texans not having health insurance. And Melissa's written a lot about sort of the impact of Rick Perry's refusal to expand Medicaid in the state that helps keep a lot of people without insurance. But there was a everybody get insured, yay Obamacare press conference in Dallas earlier this month. And I happened to be in town, and I went to check it out. And Congressman Mark Vesey, who represents kind of funny-shaped new district from Dallas to Fort Worth. It kind of stretches between the two cities and has this really narrow band that connects the two. It's a suburban district. It's about two-thirds Latino and another 15% Black. But it's, you know, it's not in the Valley. It's not in an inner-city area of the state that's well known as a hotbed of crime or poverty. But
right.
But it turns out that this district that he represents in Dallas-Fort Worth has the highest uninsured rate of any district in the country. Almost 40% of the people who live in this area, which includes like Oak Cliff, which is a pretty trendy place to live in Dallas, and kind of like the Brooklyn, of Dallas. And Cowboy Stadium, Six Flags. They're all in this district, but also just a huge number of uninsured people.
So I was surprised, you know. I guess if you had asked me what is the congressional district in the U.S. that has the highest rate of the uninsured, I might have thought it was in Texas. That would have been up there among the states. And then if you said, okay, it's in Texas, then I would have scratched my head a little bit and I would have said, okay, I bet you it's a border district, or maybe, an inner city Houston district or something like that. I would not have guessed that it would have been this particular congressional district. Any thoughts on how it edged out some of the poorer areas in South Texas, for example?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought was interesting about this. And I asked the congressman, you know, why he thought his district had the highest uninsured rate. And basically he said, you know, I have a lot of minority residents and a lot of folks who, he said, urban areas as well, like older urban areas. He said those are the folks who get hardest hit when the economy goes south. I mean, there's Bell Helicopters, has a big plant that employs a lot of people. They've laid off a bunch of folks in the last few years. So I think generally speaking, like, that has a lot to do with it. But I think that there are two things that really came together to make this happen. One is the way that his district was formed was in this redistricting process that was run by Republicans in Texas to create sort of one mega Democratic district that poured in all as many Democrat or likely Democrats as possible. It's a minority opportunity district, so it was going to be heavily minority. And this would be the one kind of safe Democratic district to make sure that the other Republican districts around it were safer. So we kind of poured in a lot of folks into this district with a funny shape. It's not totally rural. There are a lot of jobs around there, but, you know, maybe not very well-paying jobs. And so the folks who maybe lack health insurance but keep it from being the poorest part of the state are folks who earn enough to qualify to not qualify for Medicaid. You know, so they're above that really low bar
right.
the state has, but they also earn too much to qualify for. They are not enough to qualify for like new subsidies in the healthcare marketplace, and they can't really afford their own health insurance privately. So they're in this, what we talk about, the coverage gap that's been created because Texas hasn't expanded Medicaid. There are a lot of folks who kind of fit that description who live in this one area.
So I think that's really a really kind of key point here, which is that we have this group of people too poor for Medicaid, I mean too rich for Medicaid, too poor for the other parts of Obamacare, and many of them would qualify for under Medicaid expansion, but the state of Texas has rejected it.
Right.
So, you know, for supporters of Obamacare, this is an ongoing problem. You know, we still have, in this state especially, a lot of people that are uninsured and will continue to be uninsured.
Yeah, and they're who are working and have families, and they're, you know, paying rent and doing all these things, but it's just the health insurance is that one extra thing that's a couple hundred bucks a month they just can't afford.
Working poor, right.
From there, we go to a story about, am I reading this correctly, about a fracking ban in Denton? They're banning it?
you're reading that right, yes. But, of course, it hadn't happened yet. There's a group of citizens in Denton that have launched a petition drive. They're going to gather enough signatures, likely to get something on the ballot for November, that would essentially ban fracking within the city limits of Denton. And they would be, if they accomplish that, if the voters approve that in November, they would be the first city in Texas to have an outright ban on fracking, and really one of the few in the country to do that. And Texas, obviously being a big oil and gas state, this is a big, fracking deal. There I said it. Denton is in a very productive part of the Barnett Shale in North Texas. There's a lot of oil and gas production.
Those lazy college kids, not producing a whole lot.
The jazz program at the University of North Texas is leading the way on this. No. There's actually, something like 275 active gas wells within the city limits of Denton. Many of these wells are close to homes, so you have people trying to live their lives in close proximity to a lot of industrial activity. Hydraulic fracturing that's occurring to recover natural gas. And there's people in Denton who have, basically just gotten fed up with, in their view, lack of action, certainly from the state, but also from local leaders, and have decided to go the full Monty and just basically ban it within city limits. There have been some ordinances passed that do restrict drilling, but there's some loopholes, I guess you could call them. For example, while you can't put a producer cannot drill a well within, I think it's 1,200 feet of an existing residence, developers can come in and build new homes within close proximity to homes. And some people feel like that setback is still not enough because of exposure to air pollution, noise, lights, trucks, potential groundwater contamination, the whole gamut of things that bother people about fracking.
Are there other Texas cities that have proposed bans, and how successful are they looking at this point?
Not like this.
So this is quite different.
Dallas has gone pretty far. It's usually kind of referred to as a de facto ban. Denton's a little bit of a different case because there's not actually a whole lot of the Barnett Shale doesn't extend very much into Dallas. There's not a whole lot of opportunities for production anyway. Denton sits in a pretty sweet spot for gas, so there's a lot of activity there. And again, I mean, this is interesting because it's being led by citizens. I mean, they have to only gather, I think, something like 500-600 signatures in order to get this on the ballot. Now, that's not the hard part. The hard part is getting the voters to approve it, because, of course, not everybody's going to agree with this. Some people get royalties. Other people maybe work in the industry or just generally don't like the idea of a ban. I think actually the biggest threat, though, beyond that is the Texas legislature, which is extremely, friendly to the oil and gas industry and is not going to be real crazy about cities banning fracking. And then two, the industry itself is almost certain to sue. That'll be expensive litigation, because I hear the oil and gas industry has a lot of money. And I don't know about
I've heard something similar.
I won't be surprised when we see legislation next session trying to ban cities from banning.
Everyone loves local control, though. Who's going to argue with local control?
Well, remember, though, there was an effort to ban bag bans at the legislature.
Right.
Remember,
the bag ban.
Right, because Austin and some other cities did do away with single-use plastic bags.
Freedom
some
bags.
People at the, yes.
Yeah. Freedom bags.
So we've got to protect our precious freedom bags.
One of the other things that I think is interesting about this is the difference between the Barnett Shale up north and the Eagleford Shale in the south, where production has been going on a little bit longer in the Barnett Shale. And so cities, I mean, when I lived in Dallas, this was a big deal. The anti-fracking movement was getting going there, and it was based on people who knew folks around Fort Worth and the suburbs there who had heard things that were problems and said, well, we don't want the air pollution or the noise or whatever is going to happening in Dallas. And so there was this idea that it was sort of maturing into a sort of citizens revolt against fracking that maybe has been happening in Denton as well. But then also that you have, I mean, the Barnett Shale is a much more populated part of the state than the Eagleford in the south.
That's right. And, interestingly, the Eagleford Shale, it has a lot more oil in it, and oil prices are fairly high right now. Gas is a pretty historic low, and so we're seeing tons of activity in South Texas in the Eagleford Shale, which stretches from north of Laredo on the border, almost in kind of into East Texas for something like 400 miles. So it's a big area. It's very productive. Production has just exploded. The area, for people who are familiar with it, has just really transformed. And it's always been kind of a backwater, brush country. There wasn't a whole lot of population growth, no major cities, just kind of farming, ranching, in small towns. And now it's really a sight to see. And it hasn't gotten the same scrutiny, I think, from the media, from regulators, from environmental interests that the Barnett Shale has gotten for some of the reasons that you pointed out. Now this week, there was a big investigative project by Inside Climate News, the Weather Channel, I didn't know did these things, and the Center for Public Integrity. They spent 8 months down in South Texas looking into air emissions, air pollution from fracking activity and fracking infrastructure, and basically trying to get a handle on how is this impacting people. For those it has impacted, how is the industry and the state government reacting? And their findings were, and I know it's probably not surprising for some of our listeners, but that people were reporting health effects, were complaining about it, were trying to get some attention, and basically were met with indifference, if not outright hostility in some cases, by the agencies in the state that are charged with protecting public health and safety. And there's some findings in the article that sort of underscore what a lot of us have reported on this, have discovered, which is that one of the issues is that even when, for example, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality or the Railroad Commission finds some wrongdoing, maybe somebody was exposed, there were emission levels that were way beyond the legal limit or the permitted limit, they'll sort of ask the company nicely to fix it, but there won't be much of a penalty.
There's a tendency to treat any one instance where they get a complaint as, this was one really abnormal flare, or something went wrong,
right.
and they said they fixed it, so... So it's probably fine now.
And that's sort of the semi-official policy of the state, which is we work with industry to try to fix the problem. We don't punish them. There's many problems. That one is that you sort of don't have much of a deterrence effect. I mean, if crime goes unpunished, it's likely to happen again.
Sure.
And one of the things that really, sort of amused me is that, the reporters did a separate story in addition to their two main kind of features, which was basically about, I don't remember the exact headline, but something like how people tried to stop us or thwart our reporting.
Right.
And basically the gist of it was that they had very, very little cooperation from public agencies and the industry in trying to ascertain just basic facts about what was going on. And I spoke to one of the reporters today and asked him how that compared with other states. And he said it was unusual, the degree to which the agencies, TCEQ and the Railroad Commission, were unwilling to even answer questions.
Welcome to our world.
Yeah.
Right. I'm like, finally, somebody noticed.
Right.
Well, guys, thanks so much for sharing those stories.
Thank you.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schultz. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.